All right. Well, hello, everyone, for joining us. Thank you very much. And I'm Beth Park, Executive Director of the Society of Environmental Journalists. And I'm here with Peter O'Brien, Executive Director of the Environmental Film Festival in the nation's capital, which is online at dcenvironmentalfilmfest.org. And Peter and I want to welcome you to this online discussion. We'll be focused on environmental history, environmental journalism, some ideas and questions sparked by this new documentary film, A Fierce Green Fire. And Peter, I want to thank you for partnering with SEJ on this event, and we do hope that SEJ can organize this kind of preview and discussion again in the future, either with your festival or perhaps other film festivals around the country.
Well, thank you, Beth. We're very glad to partner with SEJ and showcase this really extraordinary film, which our festival will be screening in Washington, D.C. on March 19th. The 21st Annual Environmental Film Festival in the nation's capital will be screening over 190 films from March 12th to the 24th in Washington. And for our complete schedule, people should look at our website, dcenvironmentalfilmfest.org, in mid-February. I want to turn it over now to Mark Weiss, the executive producer of Fierce Green Fire, who will be leading the conversation and will introduce our other special guests. If callers have questions, and we hope you do, you should email Mark Weiss during the conversation at mweiss@weblab.org. That's M-W-E-I-S-S at weblab.org, so he can call on you later. Mark was the executive producer of A Fierce Green Fire, as I mentioned. Over the course of his career in media, he's worked in print, independent film, digital media, and television, including creating the award-winning public TV series POV, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary. Now Mark is working full-time on climate issues with the Sierra Club. So with that, I'll hand it over to you, Mark.
Thanks, Peter, and Beth. Thank you both for hosting this, and thank to everybody for joining us today. I was going to say this afternoon, but I think in some time zones it's probably morning, and others it's probably nighttime. So just want to tell you, give you a very brief kind of outline of logistics. One, some of you may have tried to go to the video to see the live streaming. Unfortunately, we're going to have to be audio only today. We did a test of the video the other night, and we discovered that what's supposed to be a live video feed is actually about 15 seconds delayed. So we're disappointed that we won't be able to use that in conjunction with the call. So we've announced that this will run about 45 minutes. Obviously, if your schedule makes it necessary to peel off before that, feel free to do so. If there's interest, we'll do a time check when we get close to that 45 minutes. If there's interest, we can extend the conversation. And the other thing I'm going to just mention is that Mark is very happy to make himself available for one-on-one interviews outside of this call. And I won't speak for Phil, but Phil, can you do that too if there's a request for that?
Sure.
Great. So I'll send out email addresses for both Phil and Mark after the call. You can contact them directly. So I'm going to kick this off with by introducing our two guests, our two distinguished guests, and a couple of starter questions, and then hopefully it opened up to participants. And let me just tell you, I'm using, in addition to moderating this, I'm also the tech guy behind the controls, in theory. So I'm going to try and turn this on to presentation mode now, which will mute everybody else's line, and then I can selectively unmute as we get to the Q&A period. Now let's see if this works. Okay, so I'm now, according to my control panel, I'm the only one who we can hear right now. So I just want to begin by introducing Phil Shabakoff, who, as I'm sure many of you know, has had a really path-breaking career in print, both as a reporter for the New York Times from 1959 to 1999, and is the author of 5 books, the most recent of which is Places, Habitats of a Human Lifetime, which is a kind of a ecological memoir. It's published just December of 2012. Phil was the Times environmental correspondent from 1977 to 1999, and his entry in Wikipedia says he's been described as a pioneer for breaking new ground in defining environmental news and setting a standard for coverage that earned him the sobriquet Dean of Environmental Journalism. His first book, A Fierce Green Fire, was published in 1993, and it's the definitive history and analysis of American environmentalism. He was also co-founder of the Society of Environmental Journalists, SEJ. So I wanted to begin. I'm going to introduce Mark in just a moment, but I wanted to begin with a question to Phil. And I'd like, Beth, if you could join us for this call, for this question. I've just unmuted you, I think. Are you there? Oh, boy. May not have happened. So, Beth, you can do this manually if you press *6 on your phone. That should unmute you. Beth, if you're with us, please. I'm going to try this one more time. The technology is not. Okay. Beth. All right, now it should work. So, Beth, if you could press *6, you should be able to join us now.
Hello? Greetings?
Hi.
Hello,
sorry about
everyone.
That. Little
did that work?
Unwieldy technology. Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. I hope it
so
was worth
Beth,
the wait.
Can you ask the question you had for Phil?
Okay. Well, Phil, you know, the whole news reporting being the first draft of history, you know, I was thinking about the historians, that you have really gone from being the first draft of history guy to an historian, and this film does that as well. So the question that came to me was, what suggestions would you have as an environmental historian for reporters who are covering the beat today and doing that first draft of history that's going on right now?
Phil, you need to press *6, and that'll unmute your line.
Mark,
yeah,
maybe you should just ask the question.
Thanks, great. Thanks, Beth, and hi, Mark. Yeah, well, first let me say that Mark Kitchell's film is really terrific, and it really brings to life the populist movement that began late 60s, early 70s, captures the excitement and the faces of it. Really, really good job. What print journalists and other journalists can do is fill in a lot of what things like the film can't do, a lot of the background, the politics, the economics of it. And bringing them all together, and I mean, we need a lot more concentration in the media today on environmental news. Somehow, everything else gets covered, you know, in great depth. But the destruction of the planet, our natural habitat, is the only thing that really doesn't get in-depth coverage anymore, and it's up to it's up to us to make sure people get the word about what's happening to the world and respond to it. Hello? Hello, hello?
Hi, am I still on?
Thanks, Phil.
I noticed bylines showing up in that film, you know, especially with regard to Love Canal and suggesting that, you know, news reporting plus activists reading the news equals some social change. And I wondered, did you think that was an unusual case, or do you feel, you know, the media coverage has that catalyst role and can play that and should be playing that role?
Absolutely. I'm not sure about the wild card of social media and what role they can play in doing things like affecting environmental legislation and enforcement. But the traditional media are absolutely essential in getting the word out about what is happening and what is not happening. The old major media are not giving it the kind of due attention it deserves. Probably never have, but it seems to have gotten worse in recent years, which is strange because the pool of available journalistic talent to investigate and write about these stories is bigger and better than ever. I'm not sure what the answer is, but the situation needs to get better.
I guess I'll do one more thing, and then I'm going to mute my own line. One time I got to sit in the room with Ben Bradley, and we were talking about consolidation and, fewer newspapers even. At that time it was in the 90s. And he made a comment that he felt that, I mean, of course you want more outlets, but that it didn't take so much the number of news outlets as, how did he say, a bright bulb on the staff, a lot of energy in the people who are doing the reporting, shining a very bright bulb light on whatever. And maybe that's a segue, Mark, to Mark Kitchell talking about the film, since there's a lot of lighting involved. But that idea of the deep dive and the intense look at things being as powerful as many shallow looks. Curious about that.
Well, just let me say one thing about the concentration of media. Which, as you say, might not itself be bad, but in fact, much of the concentration is in the hands of conservative and ultra-conservative media moguls like the Murdochs, who are not very good on environmental coverage, in fact, often antagonistic.
This is Mark. I'm just muting my phone because I'm in a location where there's sirens going by right now. But I would love to introduce Mark Kitchell and bring him into this conversation. So Mark is a two-time Academy Award nominee, best known for his feature film Berkeley in the 60s, which won the Audience Award at the 1990 Sundance Film Festival. And then I believe also was selected by the National Society of Film Critics as Best Documentary of the Year, and then nominated for an Oscar. The film has become a well-loved classic, one of the defining documentaries about the protest movements that shook the U.S. during the 60s. In the 20 years since that film was made, Mark has worked in nonfiction television. He's made films for hire. He's taught at UC Santa Cruz, done a lot of freelance work, and spent almost half of that 20 years developing A Fierce Green Fire. It's been a marathon run. Mark went to NYU Film School, where he made The Godfather Comes to Sixth Street, a cinema verite look at how his neighborhood got caught up in the filming of Godfather II. And for that, he received a Student Academy Award nomination. So, Mark, if you can unmute your line by pressing *6, please join the conversation.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Mark, talk. Yeah, can hear you great. Can you talk a little bit about the inspiration for the film and how took its the shape that it's in now. I know it went through a couple of stages of development. So can you just talk a little bit about how where the idea came from and what you were what you've been trying to do with it?
Sure. I probably spent a decade after finishing Berkeley in the 60s trying various ideas, and I think one of the reasons why this one clicked is I seem to make big-picture histories of social movements, and nobody had done the environmental movement yet, which is kind of surprising when you think about it, and a real natural film. So it had that intrinsic value. I mean, the idea came from a few places. My wife suggested it on the road driving up from L.A. to San Francisco, and we started jamming on ideas. I found Phil Shavikoff's book, A Fierce Green Fire, and a book by Tim Redman and Mark Mowry called Not in Our Backyard, and I think those were the books where we began. And we tried to do a big series that would do justice to the environmental movement, which, after all, is the biggest movement the world's ever seen and incredibly diverse. And it turned into a six-part series, and I pursued that for a couple of years until Edward O. Wilson, who was advising on the film, told me, Mark, you know, you'll never get it funded, and if you do, nobody will watch it. It's just too big. You have to find a way to make it much more popular, dramatic. You have to focus in on a few. He said pick five of the most dramatic and important events and people and tell that story. It was good advice. I went home and took it, but I was broke at that point, and it took me something like 5 years to get back to the film. That's the capsule version of it.
Great. Thank you, Mark. So I would like to now start calling on some of the participants in this call to ask some of the excellent questions they've been sending my way. And just a reminder, you can either email me or at a certain point we'll probably just open up all, we'll just allow you to unmute your line and jump in. It doesn't have to be sent as an email. For those who joined the call a little bit late, there's no live video stream. We had some technical problems. It wasn't not workable. So if you're wondering about that, don't worry about it. And secondly, we're going to try and do this call for about 45 minutes, which means another 25 minutes from now. We'll do a time check, see whether people want to extend. And both Mark and Phil will be available if people want to do one-on-one interviews with either or both of them. So I'd like to now ask Jennifer Madden, Jennifer Joy Madden, if you're on the line, if you could unmute your phone with a star six. Do you want to ask the question that you emailed me a little while ago? I wonder if she's with us. Well, if she's not, I will ask her question on her behalf. She talks about, there's a section early in the film about all the landmark environmental legislation in the early 1970s, during the time that Richard Nixon was president. And most of that legislation was bipartisan. Some of it was introduced by Republicans as well as Democrats. And her question is, what can we learn about the attitude of Congress in the early 70s that we can apply to Congress today?
Oh, I think this is a question that Phil loves. I think Phil should answer that question.
Okay, Mark. In the 70s, some of the strongest environmentalists in government were Republicans, people like Bob Stafford and John Hines and Jake Javits and others. It was a truly bipartisan issue, and it produced one of the great legislative achievements in American history, the series of landmark environmental laws that came out in the late 60s, early 70s, and into the late 70s. All that changed when Ronald Reagan became president, and a new conservative ideology took over the Republican Party, and the corporations went on a counterattack against environmental laws, much as they had done against successfully done against the trade union movement, and they poured a great deal of money into backing anti-environmental politicians, mostly Republican, as it turned out, and lobbying against environmental laws. And it worked. But the fact that the majority of the American people still care about the environment has blunted much of this what I call a counter-revolution. Unfortunately, much of forward progress on these issues was halted.
Thanks, Phil. Sorry, Mark, did you want to say something?
Oh, I thought so, but no, let's go on.
Okay. Also had a couple of questions from Kathy Florsheim. Kathy, if you're able to unmute your phone with star six, please chime in. Kathy, are you there? Star six should bring you in.
Hi.
Well, is that you?
I heard you.
Yes, it is.
Great. Great. So can you ask a couple of questions that you were posing last night?
Sure. I and lots of people like me, I'm 66, so I've been following these issues for all of my adult life. So as I watched the film last night, I started to wonder, who is your audience? Who are you trying to get to? Because it's not people like me. Is it people who have no idea, who don't care, who do care but don't know what to do? That's my first question. And my second one is more structural. How did you, when you finally got down to knowing that you had to pick the five or so episodes or events, decide what they were and then craft how you were going to put it all together?
Okay. On the audience, you know, we're always making it for the kids, the people coming up now. We're not supposed to make it for ourselves and our generation. And of course, I've always tried to make it for both. And we succeeded on Berkeley in the 60s, and I think we've succeeded on this film and making a film that I always broke it down as three generations or three audiences. The first is the two generations who lived through the rise of environmentalism and whose story it is. And the second generation is the generations, or the second group is the generations who've come along since, who know the importance of these issues, but have never really experienced a movement. And they deserve some sort of chance to sort of get filled in and find out what it was all about. And the third group is the kids who are coming up now and in the future who will live through the storm. And I want them to know that there was a movement, there were people who cared, that there was somebody, a foundation to build on. So, you know, and we've showed it around. I mean, some of my favorite comments are a woman in Mendocino who was just the grocery store clerk who the day after a screening just stopped me as we were in the checkout line and said, you know, my husband and I, we were up until 3 a.m. last night talking about all the things that we used to do and don't do now and need to do again. And there was another student at Middlebury College who already works on the Climate Reality Project presenting. And she said, thank you for giving us all this history. We really need to know this history. And then Beth Park herself said, it doesn't go down like cough syrup. And that's important. And so, you know, we're trying to reach a wide audience. I think we can reach 10 million people. I think we can establish this as something like a defining film and get it seen far and wide. And we really depend on spreading the word this critical year of 2013 to establish the film. On the making, on the, how is the structure, how we chose the five stories, I mean, were you listening when I talked about E.O. Wilson? Because that was where the five stories came in. He was an advisor to the film, and he said you should pick five of the most dramatic and important events and people and tell that story, tell their stories. And we sat there in the Entomology Museum at Harvard and said it's got to be Brower and the Sierra Club and the Thames and the Grand Canyon. It's got to be Lois Gibbs and Love Canal. It's got to be Chico Mendez and the Rubber Tappers. And what else can you end on but climate change? And I was the one who picked Greenpeace and the whale story. I kind of wanted the cowboys, the people who made it passionate and fun and, you know, brought a sort of freewheeling 60 cents to the environmental movement. And, you know, we tried a bunch of different structures. I was trying to do both those five main stories and do a broader sweep because I understood that each of those five main stories was somehow emblematic of a part of the movement in the era. And how we mix those two together, we tried a few different things, and what I eventually came up with was an hourglass-like structure where it starts wide and then narrows down and tells that main story, and then it opens up again to explore what became of it, evolution, some version of ramifications. And that was the structure that finally worked. I was worried about it all fitting together and hanging together. I was worried about five narrators and whether that would hang together. Surprisingly enough, it all does. Or at least I think so.
May I ask one other follow-on from something you said?
Sure.
You were talking about reaching 10 million people so that it's seen far and wide. How are you going to accomplish that? How do you get those people to want to see it or even know about it?
Well, this year is critical to building awareness of the film, and there is a multiplying factor, and a lot of it has to do with the media, so we hope you will write about it and tell people about it and blog about it and teach it, all those things. We're working, our release now is working on three or four main fronts. We have a theatrical release that's growing rapidly. We're up over 20 cities and climbing. We also have been doing festivals for the last year, and we're continuing to have more and more festivals. Just as I thought it was dying off, we're getting more festivals. We're also doing a lot of work with Bullfrog Films, the venerable distributor of environmental films, on both educational distribution to colleges and such, and broader non-theatrical distribution. And then we're just working as hard as we can to get as many environmental groups, large and small, national and local, to somehow take up the film, get involved, show it, partner with us on screenings, sell it to their membership. God, we'd love to have people using it in campaigns. We made the film in five parts, in part so that it's modular and you can use pieces of it. So you can show just the part about climate change or just the part about pollution. And that's what Lois Gibbs is going to do on March 6th in New York. She's having a fundraiser for the 35th anniversary of Love Canal, which started in 78. And she is going to show just part two of the film and then urge people to go see the full film, which will be playing a few blocks away at the Cinema Village in New York. So things like that. I mean, I'm starting to compile a list, and it's looking like we are soon going to hit 100 engagements so far. And that was my goal, and we've hardly started. So we've got an international sales agent. You know, there's a lot of interest in the film. I was pretty sure that there would be a big audience for a good film on the 60s, and I was right, and I think it's going to happen even more so on this film. There'll be a big audience for a good film on the environmental movement. Mm. I think a lot of people are interested.
This is Mark Weiss. I just want to chime in and say I just got involved with the film a little bit more than a year ago when Mark called me, and we had worked together on Berkeley in the 60s. I showed it on POV in early 90s. And the reason I got involved with the film is because I think it, you know, it comes at the perfect moment. It's like many of the better independent filmmakers. Somehow Mark had the vision for this film 8-10 years ago, and turns out that his timing couldn't have been better to have the film finished in 2012, just when we're beginning to see the stirrings of a climate, a movement that's really going to take on climate in a really focused way. And just the beginning of that, but I think what the film does really well is it gives all of us a glimpse at some of the really big battles over past decades, which began by feeling like they were up against really insurmountable odds, and somehow they won. And now Section 5 of the film, of course, is about the biggest challenge ever for the environmental movement and for the world, which is climate change. And I think, you know, we need to figure out how to bring optimism into that movement. And I think this film is a very, very powerful way to remind people that even what seems impossible, if it's necessary, we have to go out and make it happen. So that's what I think the film is touching that chord for a lot of people who are seeing it. At least that's been my experience as I've talked to people after seeing the film.
May I break in here just long enough to urge people, since the film is starting to play all over the country, those of you who write for local papers or are tied to some specific community, we'd love to coordinate whatever you do, whatever you write, with the ethical engagements and other stuff in your locality. And there's a couple of websites where it's easy to find out all our schedule, all our engagements, all our screenings. And one is the website for the film, which is just afearscreenfire.com. And the other is the website for the distributor, and that's www.firstrunfeatures.com/fearscreenfire. Leave out the A at the beginning.
Yeah, you know what, Mark, I can save you the trouble of this, because we'll send in a follow-up email out to everybody, and we'll have links in that email.
Well, we hope you'll write in conjunction with screenings of the film so that people can see it.
So I'd just like to ask if there's anybody else who would like to come in with a question or a comment. Comments are also welcome. It doesn't have to be just questions. And the technology here is acting up a little bit. You may be, if you press *6, you may actually be muting yourself. So if it doesn't, if you start talking and don't hear yourself, then press *6 again. One or two people had problems getting into the conversation, I know. And in fact, everybody who's not talking, if you want to press *6, that's probably a good idea so that we don't have extraneous noise.
Hi, I have a question.
Great. Can you identify yourself, please?
Sure. My name is Lisa Button, and I'm with the University of Arizona School of Journalism. And you mentioned wanting to use the film in education, and I was just wondering if there are any plans to develop educational material like other films have done, like Shattered Glass.
This is Mark Kitchell. I'm just back on. I tried going off. Can I be heard?
Yes.
Okay. The line was skipping a little bit. I heard that it was about education. I heard mention of shattered glass, and I heard plans, but I'm not clear what the question was.
Okay. The question was some films that are used in education provide some, you know, educational materials to go with it, and I was wondering if you were planning to do anything like that.
Yes, Bullfrog Films has a DVD with two guides on it. One is a teaching guide, and the other is a discussion guide. They're similar but different, but there's written material, each about 12, 15 pages long, and it may be just the beginning of written materials and supporting materials, but it's there, it's ready.
Okay, thanks.
Sure.
Great, thank you. So, anybody else like to come in?
Yeah, just a comment. Thank you for making the point that these issues looked insurmountable at the time and impenetrable. You know, I'm in my 60s also. This is Christine Heinrichs. And being reminded of things like Love Canal and how that played out over time was very inspiring to me. And I think it really has a powerful message.
Thank you.
It's one of the great pleasures of this film, being able to tell the love story, the Love Canal story, and bring it back. It's a great story, and Lois Gibson's a great leader, and pretty powerful lesson.
So we're coming
Hello?
Up on... Hi.
Hi.
Another question coming. Can you just start by identifying yourself, please?
Yeah. Hi, this is Jennifer Joy Madden. I finally got through.
Oh, yeah.
I just wanted to know what you, for people currently in the environmental journalism business, what kind of call to action were you trying to achieve with your film?
Huh. I guess that's for me. Well, to a certain extent, Jennifer, I don't believe in call to action. At least I think that if you depend on a film to get you acting, there's a problem. And I think the film's proper role is broader and deeper. And I think, you know, what we can do is we can educate, we can inspire, we can recruit, and we can mobilize. I was not making a film that's about one issue like, you know, oceans or climate or extinction. And so there wasn't one message that we could push, and there wasn't one call to action we could do. We did try a solutions-based ending, which was, look at what the Sierra Club is doing on Beyond Coal campaign, and look what California is doing on Climate Solutions Act, and a lot of things like that. And that did not work either. We felt that that was too reductive. And so we decided we would leave the film at as high a level as possible, and talking about, you know, civilizational change, and try and show instead of say that everybody ought to be active and out there doing something. So that's why that mosaic at the end, where we show people worldwide acting on a broad range of issues, you know, partly because we needed to get the film over too. But, you know, I hope it'll cause people to think, and then they'll find the action deeper within themselves, you know? We can't do it for them.
Right. Thank you. That mosaic was really phenomenal.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Jennifer.
So we're coming up on, it's 42 minutes past the hour now, and I said we'd do
Mark,
a time check. Yes.
I have one other question. This is Kathy Florsheim.
Great. Come on in.
Have you guys in distributing thought about going to community libraries, possibly getting a donor to give the film to the library? Because that's how people see, that's how I saw The Cove.
Well, I have heard of that, and I have had at least one person who has done that up in Mendocino County. They bought copies, and they bought two. The idea is to buy two and give one to the library, right?
Yes.
We're somewhat constrained in that way because Bullfrog Films is supposed to do the sales to the libraries. And I suppose once we're finally done with the film, we have a few more costs to cover. I suppose we can start applying for grants to allow us to, you know, give films to libraries. And we could also put out the appeal for people to buy it for libraries. But that sounds like another year down the road. But anybody who'd like to... I'm sorry.
I'm not trying to make your road longer. I was trying to think of how you could involve more community grassroots level participation and knowledge of the history. Libraries can do that.
Well, yes indeed. You know, we're certainly working on screenings at libraries and community groups at that level. And, you know, maybe one of the best ways to do this is just people who get inspired by the film, like you, Kathy, can go to your local library and say, I want you to show this film, I want you to buy this film. You know, wherever I go, I stop in at the library and pitch the film.
Well, there's also... the possibility of going to the people like me or anybody in a small community. I live in Rhode Island and Providence. We're small. And we have two repertory film cinemas. And I know I can get the owners of both of them.
Great.
I'm not trying to toot my own horn because that's not the point. But certainly there are other people who probably can do the same thing.
Oh, there are people. There are people who are doing that very thing. And, yes, please. You know, it's almost like going back to the days of underground filmmaking. It's certainly grassroots in that sense, that we're going to reach a lot of audiences just by networking through grassroots people and groups who care about the film and want to do something and bring it to their community and their organization. So please do. You know, and we're going to devote our lives this year of 2013 to getting the film out as far and wide as we can, so we stand ready to help.
So this is Mark Weiss again. You know, I'd like to bring Phil back into the discussion. A lot of the discussion has been focused on the film. Phil,
as it should be.
Well, yes, but you have this perspective that goes really a sweeping perspective, having lived through many of the events that are documented in the film and done the scholarly work on the history of the environmental movement and so forth. And would really appreciate your thoughts about the kind of what presents now. Everybody is clear that there are, you know, that there is a political gridlock in Washington, that it's not the Congress of the 1970s anymore. There are a lot of other much larger forces at work. But people, I would assume most of the people on this call are pretty aware about the urgency of addressing the overarching issue of climate change, as well as many of the other issues addressed in the film, you know, everything from land use to ocean to wildlife. What do you see from where you sit, Phil, do you see a movement that is moving ahead and is clear-eyed about what to do, or do you see one that is, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but do you see some, any hope emerging, any light emerging, or as the song goes, green growing through the cracks in the sidewalk?
Yeah. Well, to tell the truth, I don't see a coherent environmental movement at all at the moment. I see a lot of good people who are doing a lot of good things. I think one of the encouraging things is political on the scene now, that the emergence or reemergence of a perspective that calls for activism by the government, and was the fact that this recent presidential election was won chiefly by grassroots organizing. And I think that's going to be the answer. If we're going to move ahead, it's going to have to be by people on the ground organizing locally, regionally, nationally, globally, to face the very, very dire threats that we're facing. And I see promise in the current activity. I think we need to get our economic houses in order so that our attention can be more focused on these very critical issues. And I think once that happens, I think the environmental movement may be reinvigorated and play a more decisive role than it currently is. One thing that the film did show very clearly is that it is people. It is people who get energized and organized that make change. That is one of the essential messages of the film, and one of the things I believe is true.
Thank you, Phil. So I just want to say that we are now at close to 50 minutes past the hour. We can formally close this out. If there is interest, certainly welcome to keep talking. I'm not going to discontinue the conference call, but I know everybody has busy schedules, so you may want to move on to other activities. But Phil and Mark, can you stay on for a few more minutes if there are any additional questions or conversation on this?
Sure. Yeah.
And
yes.
Ben, great.
Mark,
thank you all for joining us. Sorry, Beth.
Mark?
Yes.
It's Judy Robinson up in Canada. I just sent you an email. I'm wondering if you're doing anything for high school students, putting together some curriculum for them to use along with the film, because I can really see this being used in schools.
Yes, there is a teaching guide, and it comes on the disc, the DVD, from Bullfrog Films. And there's two versions of it. There's a teaching guide and a viewer discussion guide. And I think it's for you to choose which you'd like to use. It includes questions and so on. And, of course, we could have written something 100 pages instead of a dozen pages. But there is a discussion guide, and it is aimed at high school students.
That's great. Are you going to have an interactive website as well that they can use?
I haven't been able to get any funding for a companion book or for a companion website. At this point, we've got about 5 websites for the film, but they're all pretty much geared towards informing people and selling the film and where can I see it and getting to watch the trailer. One thing to say about the film is that it's meant to be a gateway, and this is where we hope, particularly those of you in SEJ, will take it and really, like Phil Shabakov said, fill it out and talk about the local angles and talk about what's going on now in more depth and where things are headed and just, you know, the most we could fit into 100 minutes was of necessity something like a greatest hits of the environmental movement. And we really hope that you'll build on it and use it as a gateway for discussions. You know, so we'd love to collaborate with you if you want to volunteer to write something.
Yeah. Well, I'd be interested in doing some of that. Yeah.
Okay, great. Great.
I can see teenagers really loving this film.
Yeah. And they particularly love Paul Watson.
Yeah, oh yeah, for sure, yeah.
Are you in Western Canada?
I'm in Toronto.
Okay.
I'm in Toronto, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
are you bringing it to Hot Dogs?
I was at Hot Dogs pitching it in 2010 or 2011. Yeah.
So not as a finished film, because the Hot Dogs likes to premiere films, and it's already premiered. It premiered at Sundance,
yeah.
And it's been playing festivals around the world. So the timing isn't very good for Hot Dogs.
That's too bad.
It just played at Peterborough in Ontario.
Oh.
But we missed that. But I want this film to play at Niagara Falls.
Yeah.
So maybe we need to project it on the falls.
Yeah. That's a neat idea.
At the Love Canal Cinema.
Well,
yeah, we hope people will. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
So,
okay.
If there are no other questions, we can formally wrap up. I was about to say thank you, everybody, for joining this call and for participating in this first ever SEJ Environmental Film Festival in our nation's capital joint forum. I'm sure that both hosts would love to get feedback from anybody who's still on the line about what you think worked well and what could be improved next time around. This was a learning experience for all of us. But really appreciate your taking the time to see the film and to join the call. And as I said, we will send a follow-up email out this afternoon with email addresses for both Phil and Mark, as well as links to some of the websites that Mark was describing.
That's great.
Beth, do you have any final words that you wanted to?
Just thank you to everyone for your time and patience as we worked out some bugs. A very low-tech approach here, but I think it worked. And the human factor, after all, as Phil said, is what matters. So we communicate. But bravo on the film, and good luck with it. We'll stay in touch.
And thank you, Phil, and thank you, Mark, for all of the huge work that you've done in this field and continue to do.
Thank you.
And you too, Mark. You're doing great work. Keep it up. Thanks so much for having us.
Okay. Take care, everybody.
Goodbye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.